Today we're going to discuss the status of the Jews under Islamic rule. Approximately 130 years after the completion of the Talmud, the Muslim religion is established by Muhammad. And between 629 and 732, Muhammad and his followers conquer virtually the entire Near East, as far west as North Africa and Spain, and as far east as India, Pakistan. And they conquer all of Eretz Yisrael, Bavel, and Egypt, and therefore most Jews live in Muslim lands. Yerushalayim is captured either 637 or 638. Now, what are the fundamental principles of the Muslim religion? Well, the Quran, meaning the recital, that's the holy scripture of Islam, and the Muslims believe that it was revealed to Muhammad part by part between 610 and his death in 632. The Hadith, or the story or narration, is a body of oral tradition providing information about what Muhammad said, did, and approved or disapproved. These stories make their appearance between, let's say, 680 and 700. The Sunnah, or the trodden path of Muhammad, which is the way that he conducted himself in life, as learned from the Hadith, serves as the model for the Muslim believers. Now, the duty of the Muslims are known as the five pillars. The first is a profession of faith, that there is no God except Allah. Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. The second pillar is prayer. Formal ritual prayer is called salat, and less formal, more spontaneous prayer is the dua. The prayer includes both of these forms. Five prayer times are prescribed: dawn, midday, afternoon, evening, and night. Prayer can be said privately or in a congregation, and if in a congregation, a prayer leader directs it. Prayer is on Fridays, that's the Sabbath of the Muslims, and it takes place in a mosque. Charity is a pillar of faith. There's an obligation to give 2.5% of your income, mostly for the poor, but also to redeem captives or to maintain public facilities. The fourth pillar of faith is fasting during Ramadan, the ninth month of the year, when the Muslims believe that the Quran was revealed. On each day, there is no eating, drinking, or marital relations, but at night, this is permitted, and there is celebration. The fifth pillar is the pilgrimage, or the Hajj. This takes place at the beginning of the 12th month of the Muslim calendar. Every Muslim who is able is required to make the pilgrimage at least once in his lifetime. Now, some Muslims add a sixth pillar, jihad, or holy war, although most see this as merely being mandatory but not a pillar. According to Muslim tradition, the world has two parts to it. There's the house of Islam and the house of warfare. And those in the second category choose conversion, or they submit to Muslim rule. The battle is a holy war, and all are obligated to participate. If they die in the war, they are rewarded with paradise in heaven. Now, in 691, the Dome of the Rock was built in Yerushalayim by the order of Caliph Abd al-Malik. There are different theories as to why it was built. Some argue that he intended it to be a religious monument of a victory over the Christians that would distinguish Islam's uniqueness within the common Abrahamic religious setting of Yerushalayim. There was already a Beis HaMikdash, there was a Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and now they need a Muslim religious shrine. Others argue that Abd al-Malik sought to build a structure to divert the focus of the Muslims in his realm from the Kaaba in Mecca, where Ibn al-Zubayr, a rival caliph, controlled, and he used the annual pilgrimage to denounce Abd al-Malik and the Umayyads. The Umayyad dynasty. Now, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam, was built on top of the Temple Mount, and the Muslims believe that Muhammad was transported from the Great Mosque of Mecca to Al-Aqsa during a spiritual journey. It was built by Omar, the second caliph after Muhammad died, but it was rebuilt and expanded by Abd Malik. Now, when people say that Yerushalayim is the city of the three Abrahamic faiths of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and we ask, what is the connection that Islam has to Yerushalayim? Well, this is it, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Raphael Judah Tzvi Werblowski was an Israeli scholar of religion specializing in comparative religion and interfaith dialogue. He very much favored discussions between Jewish, Muslim, and Christian intellectuals. He served as the dean of faculty of Humanities at Hebrew U in the 60s, and he passed away about 7 years ago. He wrote an article about the meaning of Yerushalayim to Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And regarding the Muslim claim to Yerushalayim, he argues that Muhammad was never in Yerushalayim, but the Muslims copied most of their religion from the Jews and the Christians. Now, the Quran refers to Muhammad going from the holy mosque to the remote mosque. This is in the Surah 17, verse 1, which says, "Praise be to Allah who brought his servant at night from the holy mosque to the remote mosque, the precincts of which we have blessed." Again, the original meaning of this remote mosque may have implied a heavenly Jerusalem, a Yerushalayim Shelamala, as it were. Eventually, this verse came to mean that Muhammad was miraculously transported from the holy mosque, from Mecca, to the remote mosque, Yerushalayim, and from there to heaven. Now, when Caliph Abd al-Malik builds Al-Aqsa, the remote mosque, and links it to the journey of Muhammad to heaven. Now, Yerushalayim is holy to the Muslims because of a belief of a holy event that Muhammad journeyed from here to heaven and then built a holy site. That's the Muslim connection to Yerushalayim. The Christian connection to Yerushalayim has a much stronger claim than the Muslim claim. The Christians believe that uniquely Christian historical events took place and many holy sites are associated with these events. However, the Jewish view of Yerushalayim is fundamentally different than the Christian or Muslim view of Yerushalayim. Because for the Christian or the Muslim, the Yerushalayim is holy because certain historical events may have happened there or certain holy sites may be located there. But for the Jewish people, Yerushalayim is not merely a city with holy sites or a city that commemorates holy events. For the Jew, the city itself is holy. Yerushalayim is the city that God chose as the center and the symbol of the Jewish people. Yerushalayim is the soul of Israel. So it's a much, obviously, deeper connection between Yerushalayim and the Jewish religion. In any case, what was the status of Jews under Muslim rule? Now, the Muslims were anxious to convert both the Jews and the Christians to their new religion. As mentioned, some Muslims believe that jihad or holy war was a pillar of faith, although most see this as merely being mandatory but not a pillar of faith. Muslims believe, again, that there should be a holy war and everyone is obligated to participate in this holy war, and they hope to convert Jews in this holy war. Now, Jews by now had learned to resist the pressure of conversion. And the struggle between Judaism and Islam was far different than the struggle between Judaism and Christianity. See, the current structure between Judaism and Islam lacked the intimacy and bitterness that characterized the early relations between Jews and Christians when the Christians broke away from Judaism. Additionally, the debate between Judaism and Christianity focused on the validity of halacha, on the question as to whether the Mashiach had come, on the incarnation and the ascension of Jesus, and on the nature and definition of divinity. However, the debate between Judaism and Islam was much simpler, whether prophecy had ended before or with Muhammad, and the tension between the two legal codes. Additionally, Jews were far more educated and better informed about their religion than the Muslims. What did the Muslims offer their religion that the Jews did not have? All they could offer was physical comfort and political success. But to a spiritually advanced people like the Jews, this was not sufficient. The Muslims established a code of laws by which the Jews and the few Christians who remained in the lands which they conquered were forced to live. It was known as the Pact of Omar, attributed to Caliph Omar Abd al-Khattab, who ruled from 634 to 644. The object of the Pact of Omar was to make it perfectly clear that members of another religious group were inferior to Muslims, but these groups were protected individuals and were not to be physically persecuted, and they were called dhimmis. Now, non-Muslims were forbidden to speak disrespectfully of Muhammad and his religion. They could not prevent one of their members from joining Islam. They were heavily taxed. No new synagogues could be built, though old ones could be repaired. No synagogue or church, for that matter, could tower higher than a neighboring mosque. Members of another religion could not ride on horses, but only on mules, nor could they carry swords. In general, non-Muslims were to be dressed as to be easily distinguished from Muslims. Now, in 850, the caliph ordered non-Muslims to be forced to wear a yellow patch on their sleeves as well as a yellow head covering. See, Hitler did not make up the idea of the yellow star. This is already 1,100 years before Hitler came to power. It should be noted, however, that the regulations contained in the Pact of Omar were not as strict as they might have been, and many of these rules were not enforced too strictly, and before long, Jews were holding high positions of trust and honor under various caliphs. Most important of all for the life of the Jews in Muslim lands was that the new religion permitted the Jews to maintain their communities and live in accordance with their own religious laws, and under the guidance of the Rosh Kola and the Yeshivot. Now, the Rosh Kola was the exilarch, was the head, was the political head of the Jewish community, and the legend has it that Bustanai, the first Rosh Kola, the first exilarch under Islam, was given a wife from the family of the defeated Persian emperor, but the legend also states that he was a member of the House of David. Whether this legend is true or not, it is clear that the Rosh Kola, each one was descended from the House of David, from Malchus Beis David, and they stood at the head of the Jewish community. The two big yeshivot at the time were Sura and Pumpadisa, and there was a close relationship between these two institutions of the Rosh Kola and the Gaonim. And the Rosh Kola, of course, is the leader, and even the greatest scholars of the generation acknowledge the Rosh Kola as the overall leader of the Jewish community. The position of the Rosh Kola was hereditary, but the caliph still had to officially select the Rosh Kola. Additionally, the firstborn was not always chosen, but rather the member of the family who was most suitable and accepted by the yeshiva heads and the important merchants who wielded influence in the court of the caliph. If you read descriptions of the Rosh Kola that's found in the historical work of Natan HaBavli, he was a 10th century historian, he describes how the Rosh Kola represented splendor and majesty. He had a whole entourage following him around, taking care of him. And perhaps this was a small scale of the ancient monarchy of Malchut Yehuda, perhaps. The Rosh Kola exhibited certain governmental functions. He appointed judges. He had an authoritative say in matters of Jewish law, officially, and their organization of yeshivot, and he collected taxes for the caliph. So who were the Gaonim? The Gaonim were the heads of the yeshivos, or the most prominent yeshivos. Now, the yeshivos before Islamic rule in Bavel and Eretz Yisrael produced two Talmuds. The yeshivot in Bavel under Islamic rule did not produce any Talmuds, and we don't know the names of many scholars during this era in these yeshivos. But we know the heads of these yeshivos, and again, they were called Gaonim, probably standing for Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, head of the yeshiva of the pride of Yaakov. The Gaon was the ruler of Jewish law, subject to where the Rosh Kola exercised his power. Now, when someone had a question, only the Gaonim were authorized to communicate decisions on Jewish law and practice to other communities. There were yeshivot in both Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, but the Babylonian yeshivot wielded the most influence. There were two Yarchei Kala, one before Pesach and one before Rosh Hashanah. And during this time, many temporary students would gather at the yeshiva. It was also a time for discussing and answering the various questions that had reached the yeshivot from the various communities. Now, the Gaonim were considered the intellectual leaders of the entire diaspora, and their decisions and their responses had absolute legal validity in most Jewish communities. Now again, even though the structure of the Gaonim wasn't like the structure of the Rosh Kola, handed down from father to son, nevertheless, most of the Gaonim were selected from a very few restricted number of families of Gaonim. And there were few exceptions. But that was the situation most of the time, reserved for a few families, selected from a few families. The Gaonim were selected by the Rosh Golan and a group of scholars, but if both sides wouldn't agree on the Gaon, then sometimes each side would select its own candidate until a compromise was reached or one of its candidates died. But in any case, this was the leadership that was acceptable to the Muslims, as long as the Jews accepted to be dhimmis and agreed to be subordinate in some sense to the Muslims. Then they were able to form their own communities with the political leader called the Rosh Golah and the spiritual leader called the Gaon.